So this last section is called Living It Out, and it's probably be a bit shorter than the previous sections that I've done. Might only be 2 or 3 days, and it's a prologue. It's actually the last, very last verses of the Sutta Nipata of Pingya is. The last chapter is the way to the beyond, and there's these 16 Brahmins came to ask questions of the Buddha, and that's what each of these each sutta in this the way to the beyond is the Buddha's response or a record of the conversations between these students, and then the last question is by Pingya, and then the last verses of the whole chapter are the Pingya's praises of the way to the beyond. "I will sing you the praises of the way to the beyond," said Pingya, when he returned to where the Brahmin Bhavari lives on the banks of the river Godavari. "It was described to us by this man exactly as he saw it. But then, there isn't any reason why a man like him should lie, a mammoth of knowledge and completely pure, a man without desire. When a voice has none of the glibness of pride and none of the ingrained stains of ignorance, then its words are full of sweetness and beauty. It is such words that I praise now. They call him Buddha, enlightened, awake, dissolving darkness with total vision and knowing the world to its ends. He has gone beyond all the states of being and of becoming. He has no inner poison drives. He is the total elimination of suffering. This man, Brahma Bhavari, is the man I follow. It is like a bird that leaves the bushes of the scrubland and flies to the fruit trees of the forest. I too have left the bleary half-light of opinions. Like a swan, I have reached a great lake. Up till now, before I heard Gotama's teaching, people had always told me this. This is how it has always been, and this is how it will always be. Only the constant refrain of tradition, a breeding ground for speculation. This prince, this beam of light, Gotama, was the only one who dissolved the darkness. This man, Gotama, is a universe of wisdom and a world of understanding. A teacher whose Dhamma is the way things are, instant, immediate, and visible all around, eroding desire without harmful side effects, with nothing else quite like it anywhere in the world. But Pingya, said Bhavari, why then don't you spend all your time, your every moment, with this man Gotama, this universe of wisdom, this world of understanding, this teacher whose Dhamma is the way things are, instant, immediate, and visible all around, eroding desire without harmful side effects, with nothing else quite like it anywhere in the world. Brahman, sir, said Pingya, there is no moment for me, however small, that is spent away from Gotama, from this universe of wisdom, this world of understanding, this teacher whose teaching is the way things are, instant, immediate, and visible all around, eroding desire without harmful side effects, with nothing else quite like it anywhere in the world. You see, sir, said Pingya, with constant and careful vigilance, it is possible for me to see him with my mind as clearly as with my eyes, in night as well as day. And since I spend my nights revering him, there is not to my mind a single moment spent away from him. I cannot now move away from the teaching of Gotama. The powers of confidence and joy, of intellect and awareness, hold me there. Whichever way this universe of wisdom goes, it draws me with it. Physically, I cannot move like that. My body is decaying. I am old and weak. But the driving power of purposeful thought propels me with it without break. There was a time when, writhing in the mud of the swamps, I could only drift from one stone to the next. But then I saw the Sambuddha, fully awake and free from defilement. And the Buddha spoke. Pingya, he said, other people have freed themselves by the power of confidence. Vakali, Bhadra, Buddha, and Alavi Gotami have all done this. have all done this, you too should let that strength release you. You too will go to the further shore, beyond the draw of death. These words, said Pingya, are the words of a man of wisdom. As I hear them, I become more confident. This one is Sambuddha. He has opened the curtains and woken up. There is nothing barren there. His mind is clear and luminous. Everything accessible to knowledge is known to him, even the ultimate subtleties of Godhood. There are no more questions for the doubtful who come to him. The teacher has answered them all. Yes, I shall go there. I shall go beyond change. I shall go beyond formations. I shall go beyond comparison. There are no more doubts. You may consider this as mind released. Next sutta is Anguttara 3, 134. Whether Tathagatas arise in the world or not, it still remains a fact, a firm and necessary condition of existence, that all formations are impermanent. Whether Tathagatas arise in the world or not, it still remains a fact, a firm and necessary condition of existence, that all formations are subject to suffering. Whether Tathagatas arise in the world or not, it still remains a fact, a firm and necessary condition of existence, that all things are non-self. A Tathagata fully awakens to this fact and penetrates it. Having fully awakened to it and penetrated it, he announces it, teaches it, makes it known, presents it, discloses it, analyzes it, and explains it, that all formations are impermanent, that all formations are subject to suffering, that all things are non-self. Okay. And this sutta on the path, Samyutta 45, sutta number 8. Savati, bhikkhus, I will teach you the Noble Eightfold Path and I will analyze it for you. Listen to that and attend closely. I will speak. Yes, Venerable Sir, those bhikkhus replied. The Blessed One said this. And what, bhikkhus, is the Noble Eightfold Path? Right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration. And what, bhikkhus, is right view? Knowledge of suffering, knowledge of the origin of suffering, knowledge of the cessation of suffering, knowledge of the way leading to the cessation of suffering. This is called right view. And what, bhikkhus, is right intention? Intention of renunciation, intention of non-ill will, intention of harmlessness. This is called right intention. And what, bhikkhus, is right speech? Abstinence from false speech, abstinence from divisive speech, abstinence from harsh speech, abstinence from idle chatter. This is called right speech. And what, bhikkhus, is right action? Abstinence from the destruction of life, abstinence from taking what is not given, abstinence from sexual misconduct. This is called right action. And what, bhikkhus, is right livelihood? Here, a noble disciple, having abandoned a wrong mode of livelihood, earns his living by a right livelihood. This is called right livelihood. And what, bhikkhus, is right effort? Here, bhikkhus, a bhikkhu generates desire for the non-arising of unarisen evil or unwholesome states. He makes an effort, arouses energy, applies his mind, and strives. He generates desire for the abandoning of arisen evil unwholesome states. He makes an effort, arouses energy, applies his mind, and strives. He generates desire for the arising of unarisen wholesome states. He makes an effort, arouses energy, applies his mind, and strives. He generates desire for the maintenance of arisen wholesome states, for their non-decay, increase, expansion, and fulfillment by development. He makes an effort, arouses energy, applies his mind, and strives. This is called right effort. And what, bhikkhus, is right mindfulness? Here, bhikkhus, a bhikkhu dwells contemplating the body in the body, ardent, clearly comprehending, mindful, having removed covetousness and displeasure in regard to the world. He dwells contemplating feelings and feelings, ardent, clearly comprehending, mindful, having removed covetousness and displeasure in regard to the world. He dwells contemplating mind and mind, ardent, clearly comprehending, mindful, having removed covetousness and displeasure in regard to the world. He dwells contemplating phenomena in phenomena, ardent, clearly comprehending, mindful, having removed covetousness and displeasure in regard to the world. This is called right mindfulness. And what, bhikkhus, is right concentration? Here, bhikkhus, secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states, a bhikkhu enters and dwells in the first jhana, which is accompanied by thought and examination, with rapture and happiness born of seclusion. With the subsiding of thought and examination, he enters and dwells in the second jhana, which has internal confidence and unification of mind, is without thought and examination, and has rapture and happiness born of concentration. With fading away as well of rapture, he dwells equanimous, and, mindful and clearly comprehending, he experiences happiness with the body. He enters and dwells in the third jhana, of which the noble ones declare, he is equanimous, mindful, one who dwells happily. With the abandoning of pleasure and pain, and with the previous passing away of joy and displeasure, he enters and dwells in the fourth jhana, which is neither painful nor pleasant, and includes the purification of mindfulness by equanimity. This is called right concentration. So, prologues to put forth energy towards. The last section of this is called Keep Going, and beginning with aspects of noble friendship. Kalyanamitta as the basis for the path. This is Samyutta 45, Sutta number 77. Bhikkhus, I do not see even one other thing by means of which the unarisen Noble Eightfold Path arises, and the arisen Noble Eightfold Path goes to fulfillment by development so effectively as by this, good friendship. When a bhikkhu has a good friend, it is to be expected that he will develop and cultivate the Noble Eightfold Path. And how does a bhikkhu who has a good friend develop and cultivate the Noble Eightfold Path? Here, bhikkhus, a bhikkhu develops right view, which is based upon seclusion, dispassion, and cessation, maturing in release. Bhikkhu develops right intention, and that similarly based upon seclusion, dispassion, and cessation, maturing in release, and through the whole aspects of the path, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness. He develops right concentration, which is based upon seclusion, dispassion, and cessation, maturing in release. It is in this way, bhikkhus, that a bhikkhu who has a good friend develops and cultivates the Noble Eightfold Path. Oh, it was really the day after one prana when I did this. This is Anguttara 8, Sutta number 26, encouraging others. I've heard that on one occasion the Blessed One was staying in Rajagaha. at Jivaka's mango grove. Then Jivaka Komaravacha went to the Blessed One, and on arrival, having bowed down, sat to one side. As he was sitting there, he said to the Blessed One, "Venerable Sir, to what extent is one a lay follower?" Jivaka, when one has gone to the Buddha for refuge, has gone to the Dhamma for refuge, and has gone to the Sangha for refuge, then to that extent is one a lay follower. And to what extent, Venerable Sir, is one a virtuous lay follower? Jivaka, when one abstains from taking life, from stealing, from sexual misconduct, from lying, and from fermented and distilled drinks that lead to heedlessness, then to that extent is one a virtuous lay follower. And to what extent, Venerable Sir, is one a lay follower who practices for his own benefit, but not that of others? Jivaka, when a lay follower himself is consummate in conviction or faith, satta, but doesn't encourage others in the consummation of conviction, while he himself is consummate in virtue, but doesn't encourage others in the consummation of virtue, when he himself is consummate in generosity, but doesn't encourage others in the consummation of generosity, when he himself desires to see the monks, but doesn't encourage others to see the monks, when he himself wants to hear the true Dhamma, but doesn't encourage others to hear the true Dhamma, when he himself habitually remembers the Dhamma he has heard, but doesn't encourage others to remember the Dhamma they have heard, when he himself explores the meaning of the Dhamma he has heard, but doesn't encourage others to explore the meaning of the Dhamma they have heard, when he himself, knowing both the Dhamma and its meaning, practices in line with the Dhamma, but doesn't encourage others to practice the Dhamma in line with the Dhamma, then to that extent he is a lay follower who practices for his own benefit, but not for the benefit of others. And to what extent, Venerable Sir, is one a lay follower who practices both for his own benefit and the benefit of others? Jivaka, when a lay follower himself is consummate in conviction and encourages others in the consummation of conviction, when he himself is consummate in virtue and encourages others in the consummation of virtue, when he himself is consummate in generosity and encourages others in the consummation of generosity, when he himself desires to see the Sangha and encourages others to see the Sangha, when he himself wants to hear the true Dhamma and encourages others to hear the true Dhamma, when he himself habitually remembers the Dhamma he has heard and encourages others to remember the Dhamma they have heard, when he himself explores the meaning of the Dhamma he has heard and encourages others to explore the meaning of the Dhamma they have heard, when he himself, knowing both the Dhamma and its meaning, practices the Dhamma in line with the Dhamma and encourages others to practice the Dhamma in line with the Dhamma, then to that extent he is a lay follower who practices both for his own benefit and for the benefit of others. Okay, a refuge to friends. This is Anguttara 5, Sutta number 38. For a lay person, there are these five rewards of conviction. Which five? When the truly good people in the world show compassion, they will first show compassion to people of conviction and not to people without conviction. When visiting, they first visit people of conviction and not people without conviction. When accepting gifts, they will first accept those from people with conviction and not from people without conviction. When teaching the Dhamma, they will first teach those with conviction and not those without conviction. A person of conviction on the breakup of the body after death will arise in a good destination, the heavenly world. For a lay person, these are the five rewards of conviction. Just as the large banyan tree on level ground where four roads meet is a haven for the birds all around, even so a lay person of conviction is a haven for many people, monks, nuns, male lay followers, and female lay followers. That ends in verse. A massive tree whose branches carry fruits and leaves, with trunks and roots and an abundance of fruits. There the birds find rest. In that delightful sphere they make their home. Those seeking shade come to the shade. Those seeking fruit find fruit to eat. So with the person consummate in virtue and conviction, humble, sensitive, gentle, delightful, and mild. To him come those without asava, without fermentation, free from passion, free from aversion, free from delusion, the field of merit for the world. They teach him the Dhamma that dispels all stress, and when he understands, he is freed from fermentations, totally unbound. Asava, I would say. There isn't really a decent translation anywhere. So you get used to something, taints, as it was normally. But even that's not very satisfactory. Okay. Gutra 461. On making a living. Then the householder, Anata Pindika, approached the Blessed One. The Blessed One said to him, householder, there are these four things that are wished for, loved, and agreeable, yet rarely gained in the world. What for? One thinks, may wealth come to me in righteous ways. This is the first thing in the world that is wished for, yet rarely gained. Having gained wealth in righteous ways, one thinks, May fame spread about concerning me as well as my relatives and teachers. This is the second thing in the world that is wished for, yet rarely gained. Having gained wealth and fame, one thinks, may I live long and attain longevity. This is the third thing in the world that is wished for, yet rarely gained. Having gained wealth, fame, and longevity, one thinks, with the breakup of the body after death, may I be reborn in a good destination, in a heavenly world. This is the fourth thing in the world that is wished for, yet rarely gained. These are the four things that are wished for, loved, and agreeable, yet rarely gained in the world. There are, householder, four other things that lead to the obtaining of those four things. What for? Accomplishment in faith, accomplishment in virtue, accomplishment in generosity, and accomplishment in wisdom. And what, householder, is the accomplishment in faith? Here a noble disciple has faith. He places faith in the enlightenment of the Tathagata thus. The Blessed One is an arahant, and the standard verses, teacher of devas and humans, the enlightened one, the Blessed One. This is called the accomplishment in faith. And what is the accomplishment in virtue? Here a noble disciple abstains from the destruction of life, from stealing, from sexual misconduct, from false speech, and from wines, liquors, and intoxicants which are a basis for negligence. This is called accomplishment in virtue. And what is accomplishment in generosity? Here a noble disciple dwells at home with a mind free from the stain of stinginess, freely generous, open-handed, delighting in relinquishment, one devoted to charity, delighting in giving and sharing. This is called accomplishment in generosity. And what is accomplishment in wisdom? One who dwells with a heart overcome by covetousness and unrighteous greed, by ill will, by sloth and torpor, by restlessness and worry, and by doubt, does what he should avoid and neglects his duty. As a consequence, his fame and happiness degenerate. When a noble disciple thus understands and that thus understands that these qualities are defilements of the mind, he abandons them. When he has abandoned them, he is called a noble disciple of great wisdom, of vast wisdom, one who sees the range of vision, one accomplished in wisdom. This is called accomplishment in wisdom. These, householder, are the four things that lead to obtaining the other four things that are wished for, loved, and agreeable, yet rarely gained in the world. With the wealth acquired by energetic striving, amassed by the strength of his arms, earned by the sweat of his brow, righteous wealth righteously gained, the noble disciple undertakes four worthy deeds. What for? With the wealth thus gained, he makes himself happy and pleased and properly maintains himself in happiness. He makes his parents happy and pleased and properly maintains them in happiness. He makes his wife and children, his slaves, workers, and servants happy and pleased, and properly maintains them in happiness. He makes his friends and colleagues happy and pleased, and properly maintains them in happiness. This is the first case of wealth that has gone to good use, that has been fruitfully applied and used for a worthy cause. Further, householder, with the wealth thus gained, the noble disciple makes provisions against the losses that might arise on account of fire and floods, kings and bandits, and unloved heirs. He makes himself secure against them. This is the second case of wealth that has gone to good use. Further, householder, with the wealth thus gained, the noble disciple makes the five kinds of offerings to relatives, guests, ancestors, the king, and the devas. This is the third case of wealth that has gone to good use. Further, householder, with the wealth thus gained, the noble disciple establishes a lofty offering of alms to those ascetics and Brahmins who refrain from vanity and negligence, who are settled in patience and gentleness, who are devoted to taming themselves, to calming themselves, and to attaining Nibbana, an offering that is heavenly, resulting in happiness conducive to heaven. This is the fourth case of wealth that has gone to good use, that has been fruitfully employed and used for a worthy cause. These, householder, are the four worthy deeds that a noble disciple undertakes with the wealth acquired by energetic striving, amassed by the strength of his arms, earned by the sweat of his brow, righteous wealth righteously gained. For anyone whose wealth is expended on other things apart from these four worthy deeds, that wealth is said to have gone to waste, to have been squandered and used frivolously. But for anyone whose wealth is expended on these four worthy deeds, that wealth is said to have gone to good use, to have been fruitfully employed and used for a worthy cause. The sutta on the worldly winds. These eight worldly conditions, O monks, keep the world turning around, and the world turns around these eight worldly conditions. What eight? Gain and loss, fame and disrepute, praise and blame, pleasure and pain. These eight worldly conditioned monks are encountered by an uninstructed worldling, and they are also encountered by an instructed noble disciple. What now is the distinction, the disparity, the difference between an instructed noble disciple and an uninstructed worldling? Lord, our knowledge of these things has its roots in the Blessed One. It has the Blessed One as guide and resort. It would be good indeed, Lord, if the meaning of that statement would be explained by the Blessed One. Having heard it from him, the monks will bear it in mind. Listen then, monks, and attend carefully. I shall speak. Yes, Lord, the monks replied. The Blessed One then spoke thus. When an uninstructed worldling, O monks, comes upon gain, he does not reflect on it thus. This gain that has come to me is impermanent, bound up with suffering, subject to change. He does not know it as it really is. And when he comes upon loss, fame and disrepute, praise and blame, he does not reflect on them thus. All these are impermanent, bound up with suffering, subject to change. He does not know them as they really are. With such a person, gain and loss, fame and disrepute, praise and blame, pleasure and pain keep his mind engrossed. When gain comes, he is elated, and when he meets with loss, he is dejected. When fame comes, he is elated, and when he meets with disrepute, he is dejected. When praise comes, he is elated, and when he meets with blame, he is dejected. When he experiences pleasure, he is elated, and when he experiences pain, he is dejected. Being thus involved in likes and dislikes, he will not be freed from birth, aging, and death. From sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair, he will not be freed from suffering, I declare. But, O monks, when an instructed noble disciple comes upon gain, he reflects on it thus. This gain that has come to me is impermanent, bound up with suffering, subject to change. And so he will reflect when loss and so forth come upon him. He understands all these things as they really are, and they do not engross his mind. Thus he will not be elated by gain or dejected by loss, elated by fame or dejected by disrepute, elated by praise or dejected by blame, elated by pleasure or dejected by pain. Having thus given up likes and dislikes, he would be freed from birth, aging, and death, from sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. He would be freed from suffering, I declare. This, monks, is the distinction, the disparity, the difference between an instructed noble disciple and an uninstructed worldling. Loss and gain, this is, ends in verse. Loss and gain, disrepute and fame, praise and blame, pleasure and pain. These things are transient in human life, inconstant and bound to change. The mindful wise one discerns them well, observant of their alterations. Pleasant things do not disturb his mind, and those unpleasant do not annoy him. All likes and dislikes are dispelled by him, eliminated and abolished. Aware now of the stainless, griefless state, he fully knows, having gone beyond. Okay, the next one is the Dhamma in brief. There's a few suttas that give the follow that theme. This is Anguttara 8:53. On one occasion, the Blessed One was dwelling at Vaishali in the great wood, in the hall with the peaked roof. Then Mahaprajapati Gotami approached the Blessed One, paid homage to him, and stood to one side. Standing there, she said to him, "It would be good, Lord, if the Blessed One would teach me the Dhamma in brief, so that having heard the Dhamma from the Blessed One, I might dwell alone, withdrawn, diligent, ardent, and resolute." When, Gotami, you know of certain things, these things lead to passion, not to dispassion, to bondage, not to detachment, to accumulation, not to diminution, to having many wishes, not to having few wishes, to discontent, not to contentment, to gregariousness, not to seclusion, to indolence, not to the arousing of energy, to luxurious living, not to frugality. Of such things you can be certain, this is not the Dhamma, this is not the discipline. This is not the Master's teaching. But, Gotami, when you know of certain things, these things lead to dispassion, not to passion, to detachment, not to bondage, to diminution, not to accumulation, to having few wishes, not to having many wishes, to contentment, not to discontentment, to seclusion, not to gregariousness, to the arousing of energy, not to indolence, to frugality, not to luxurious living. Of such things you can be certain. This is the Dhamma, this is the discipline, this is the Master's teaching. And it was after that that Mahaprajapati went off, went into retreat, and was enlightened as an arhat. Just using those basic things. Yes. Yeah, she was a nun then. Next one is Anguttara 7:79. On one occasion, the Venerable Upali approached the Blessed One. Having arrived, he paid homage to the Blessed One, sat down to one side, and said, "It would be good, Lord, if the Blessed One would teach me the Dhamma in brief, so that having heard the Dhamma from the Blessed One, I might dwell alone, withdrawn, diligent, ardent, and resolute." When, Upali, you know of certain things, these things do not lead to complete disenchantment, to dispassion, cessation, and peace, to direct knowledge, enlightenment, and nibbana. Of such teachings you may be certain. This is not the Dhamma, this is not the discipline, this is not the Master's teaching. But, Upali, when you know of certain things, these things lead to complete disenchantment, to dispassion, cessation, and peace, to direct knowledge, enlightenment, and nibbana. Of such things you may be certain. This is the Dhamma, this is the discipline, this is the Master's teaching. Then Jeff uses, or Bhikkhu Bodhi uses revulsion for nipita. I find it a bit bit strong. In the English language, it doesn't have a, there's nowhere to sort of get a positive connotation into it. Disenchantment, I think, has a better, I mean, it's that sense of turning away from, which revulsion definitely turns you away from things, but disenchantment doesn't have that sort of immediate negative tone to it.